Tuesday night at the Democratic Convention, nine mothers took the stage and spoke about the black children they'd lost to gun violence. They're part of a group called Mothers of the Movement. Lucia McBath stood among them.
I lived in fear that my son would die like this. I even warned him that because he was a young black man, he would meet people who didn't value him or his life.
Lucia's son was 17 years old when he died. Teenager Jordan Davis was unarmed. The shooter was Michael Dunn, who was reportedly angered about the music that Davis and his friends were playing in a car at a gas station. Dunn was eventually convicted of murder and sentenced to life without parole. The whole story is chronicled in a documentary called 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. I spoke with Lucia McBath and filmmaker Mark Silver about that film last year, and I began by asking Mark about the title of his film.
Well, when I first heard about Jordan's story, and we spent about a week actually with Lucy and Ron, Jordan's parents, and we kind of zoomed into what actually happened during this 3.5 minutes. And I was fascinated by the...
Now, the 3.5 minutes you're referring to is the amount of time between when Michael Dunn pulled into the gas station before he shot Jordan.
That's right. These two cars pulled up next to each other in a gas station car park in Jacksonville. And of all the cars that could have pulled up next to each other, Michael Dunn and Jordan Davis did. And during the time that those two cars were next to each other was 3.5 minutes. And I wanted to explore forensically what happened during that 3.5 minutes, not just between Michael Dunn and Jordan Davis, but in a bigger way, metaphorically, what did those 3.5 minutes come to represent?
So Lucy, as I was watching the film, I kept thinking to myself, this must be what Jordan's parents went through as well, trying to understand what happened every moment. You weren't there, and for a parent, those times you can't be there with your kid
exactly.
All the time. You can't protect them all the time. So that must have been almost what it was like, piecing together what happened. What was the experience when you first watched the completed film?
Well, it was very surreal watching our story on the screen and sitting there and saying, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Because, even though you're aware and even though you're in the moment, it's still just surreal. There are just still moments where you completely are at a loss or you're really not present because you're still just dealing with, how did this happen? Why did this happen? And that just kind of supersedes anything that you're feeling or thinking from time to time because you're still mired in that thought. How did this happen? Why did this happen? So sitting in the courtroom was very profound for us because that was the first time that we actually began to understand from moment to moment to moment what really happened.
Mark, a lot of the film is completely unnarrated. You start this journey through what happened to Jordan with no comment, right? I mean, it's almost all scenes outside the courtroom, testimony inside the courtroom. Why that particular choice rather than, bringing somebody on to sort of tell the story through narration?
Well, from the beginning, I was interested in trying to put the audience in the space or the minds of the jury so that they would receive information in the same way that the jury received information. And by doing that, I felt like it wasn't that we wanted to overtly tell an audience what to think or how to think about what had happened during that 3.5 minutes, but rather let them kind of journey through the film and think about it like a jury had to think about it. And I think in that sense, it invites the audience to get more, if you like, deeply involved or more immersively involved in trying to understand what was that so-called fear that Michael Dunn felt when he pulled up next to four black teenagers in a car.
The music comes back on. I don't know if they're singing or what, but they're saying, kill them. So I put my window down again, and I said, excuse me, are you talking about me? you know, I'm still not reacting, but then this guy, like, goes down on the ground and comes up with something. I thought it was a shotgun. And he goes, "You're dead, bitch." And he opens his door. Mm-hmm. And I'm bricks. But that's when I reached in my glove box, mm-hmm. unholstered my pistol, and I shot.
I'll be the first to tell you there's no weapons in that car. I don't know what you saw.
Why would a man be conditioned to feel that fear? Do other members of the audience feel that fear? Maybe they need to check their own kind of conscious or subconscious biases. And more than that, what do people think about stand your ground laws and self-defense laws? And I think with us not commenting on that and putting the audience in the minds of the jury, it kind of forces the audience to perceive what happens during the 90 minutes of the film in a more impactful way.
Some of the most powerful testimony, audio, commentary that we hear in the film is Michael Dunn himself. You obtained access to the phone calls that he made between himself while he was in jail and his fiance.
It's absurd. Everything is absurd. It's like, I'm the victim here. It's 100% on Jordan. 100%. I don't even take 0.5%. I mean, he made that happen. But, you know, maybe he would have killed somebody if it hadn't been me.
Mark, I understand that you originally accessed those because you couldn't get an interview with him. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's right. We requested an interview with Michael Dunn and his family members via his lawyer several times during the trial, and they didn't want to be in the film. Actually, in hindsight, when we began editing the film, I realized that the truth, in inverted commas, that we were hearing via these prison phone call recordings was potentially an even greater truth than if we would have done a face-to-face interview with Michael Dunn or his family members.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that basically through the use of the phone calls, Michael Dunn's character evolves from this person who explains that he felt fear because of this argument with Jordan. And by the end of the film, his more overt views on racism are very explicit.
They're like freaking out because a white guy dared to ask him to turn their, I mean, you know, come on. If you ask me to turn down my music, I'm going to kill you. And if you tell me to mind my own business, I mean, Jesus Christ. When, you know, no wonder people are afraid to tell them to pick up their pants.
I don't know, honey.
I'm not racist. They're racist.
What I found fascinating about Michael Dunn was that he was almost, well, he was unaware of his own racism. And I think by that, the character of Michael Dunn becomes something more than just about that individual. And I think metaphorically starts to kind of speak to and for, you know, a large proportion of America that isn't ready or aware of actually speaking about their own racism.
I wonder what that was like for you, Lucy, to hear Michael Dunn saying these things. I mean, at one point, he says he might have saved someone else's life by killing your son. What was that like to listen to that?
Well, I mean, very early on, we knew that a lot of what we were dealing with was racism. But we kept that quiet. We didn't feel the need to point that finger and so-called play the race card at that moment, even though we knew that Michael Dunn was racist and pretty much could not have done what he did, not unless he had inhibited those feelings. But to actually hear it on audio and to actually see it written in the letters, the jailhouse letters, was just, it was horrible. It was horrible because it was all spelled out for us. Here, you know, our boy and the boys had come in contact with just somebody that had such horrible thoughts and ideas about, you know, people of color, about, you know, young black men. And I think it was just really so troublesome to us because we know that there are a lot of Michael Dunns walking around in the country.
Who don't think that they're racist.
Who don't think that they're racist. And that's so disheartening because, you know, we say how far we've come in this country, and we're supposed to be a post-racial society, but it appears to us, as we see what's happening in the country most recently, you know, there is a resurgence again of racism. And the thing that I find is that it's been there all along. This undercurrent of this kind of racism that we see now has been here all along. And now people seem far more relevant to wear it as a chip on their shoulder.
Mark, one of the things that really came across to me, at least, was the impact on Jordan's friends. These are our young men that were very likable, articulate, very open, and charming young men with a lot of promise. And yet one of the things that seems to be really kind of be examined in this is the fact that they don't walk away unscathed. Nobody in this situation walks away unscathed. How did you go about getting to that?
Yeah, you're right. When I first started exploring, you know, peeling back the layers of what happened during the 3.5 minutes, you know, one layer was the other boys in the car who, you know, very, very fortunately, none of those bullets hit the other boys, even though they were, you know, whizzing past them.
Did you hear any gunshots strike the car?
I remember hearing glass shatter.
And how did you feel when you were driving away, being shot at, and you heard the glass shatter?
I mean, I was in a panic. I'm just scared.
And what happened to Jordan Davis? He stays sitting up?
No, I tried to pull him down, but when I pulled him down, he just fell into my lap.
You know, each shooting that occurs in the US, it's not just about the kind of immediate victim and immediate family. There are many other people affected by this, which when you think there's around 30,000 shootings a year, that is, you know, a lot of people being affected by gun control issues. And then on an individual level, you know, each of those boys was essentially displaying some form of kind of post-traumatic stress disorder, which will take many years for them to get over. At the same time, they did say some very beautiful, you know, things to me as individuals and as a group, one of which always has stayed with me, which is this idea that because they say they came so close to death, the way that they perceive, you know, how they want their lives to unfold in the future, you know, has epically kind of evolved since that incident.
Lucy, let's hope that no other parent has to go through what you have gone through to kind of understand some of the issues of the day. I mean, everybody talks and debates about stand your ground. Everyone talks and debates about gun control and talks and debates about racism. Mm-hmm. But would none of us ever think we're going to lose our kid to these philosophical ideas? So what would you say is sort of the message of your son's death? What do you say to other parents who may still feel very disconnected from these topics?
I say to them is that I believe that what we're seeing in the country right now is kind of an awakening of the larger problems that we're dealing with, conflicts. And I think the crises that we see with, you know, all the young men that are dying in the country and then, you know, the children at Sandy Hook and all of these that we could list, all these kinds of shootings are happening. I think it's just systemic of something that's even bigger and broader in the country that has to be dealt with. And so what I try to say to those parents that, you know, and many of them, a lot of them, you know, their cases are never in the public. A lot of them have never received any justice for the murder of their loved ones. And what I try to say to them is that I think this is an awakening in the country that is going to cause us as a nation us individually, collectively, to look at just who we are and what we think about our fellow man. And how much value do you place on the lives of people that don't look, think, or act like you? And how much value do you place on communities that are outside your own focus and realm? And if you have not committed yourself to thinking about others and the plight of others in this country, then basically shame on you. Shame on you, because if you believe that what is happening in the country cannot or will not happen to you, you are sorely misguided, because the violence, gun violence now has, and the implicit biases and everything have all gone way beyond the ghetto and way beyond the urban area. And so now no one is immune to these kinds of conflicts and opinions and issues that we're dealing with.
That's my conversation with Lucia McBath and filmmaker Mark Silver from last year. Mark's documentary, 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets, examines what happened the night that Lucia's son was killed.